It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The question of whether Iran is racing toward nuclear weapons capabilities is one of the most contentious foreign policy issues challenging the West. Dealing with a nuclear-armed Iran is clearly a prospect the United States and its allies would like to avoid. The question is how. It has been months since President Obama announced an interim deal had been struck between the group known as the P5 Plus One and Iranian leadership over Iran's nuclear program. The P5 Plus One refers to the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, the U.S., China, France, Russia, and the United Kingdom, plus Germany. In late July, negotiators agreed to a four-month extension of talks, but since then, Iran has missed a major deadline to provide information about its nuclear research, declared it will not allow visits to a military site suspected of being part of nuclear component testing, and said it is completing work on more powerful centrifuges to make nuclear fuel. Now what? Engaging Iran, A New Way Forward, is the title of a program being hosted later today by the World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh at Point Park University from 5 to 6:30 this evening. It features Jessica Tuckman Matthews, president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and one of the advisory members of the Iran Project. She joins us now in Studio A. Jessica Tuckman Matthews, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Tomorrow night, President Obama is addressing the nation regarding his plans for fighting ISIS. How is all of this turmoil in the Middle East affecting how we approach this issue with Iran?
It makes a really complicated, tough technological problem an even more complicated political one. But I would say that it on balance, it's a positive because we and Iran now share at least the goal of containing ISIS and backing off its direct threat to the integrity of Iraq.
We've been hearing for some time that Iran is becoming more moderate in terms of how its political leadership is positioning itself, a little more willing to engage the West. What is really happening here, and how does it impact this scenario?
Well, last June, there was an election that's fair to call an earthquake, or whose result was an earthquake in Iran, with the election of Rouhani as prime minister in a multi-candidate race. He got more than half of the vote, and he had been very clear that his approach to international politics was moderation, flexibility, and a belief that a deal with the United States was possible. So he'd made that very clear in his campaigning, and he upset all the predictions of all the experts on the likely outcome. He then followed that up by appointing a man as foreign minister who is known very well to the West, spent many years at the UN, was educated in the West. Both of them speak perfect English. Both of them know the nuclear issue intimately in tremendous detail. And Rouhani immediately took steps to counter the anti-Israeli Holocaust-denying craziness of Ahmadinejad. So it wasn't just his campaigning, but his actions after he became prime minister that really changed Iran's behavior and posture towards the West.
So how does that impact what's going on here now? Because there's this fear that Iran is trying to build a nuclear device to have nuclear weapons capability, that seems to be pretty clear that is their aim, and the Western countries, the P5 plus one, want to prevent that. So there seems to be some room for some dialogue here, but there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of movement in the direction that the West would prefer. There doesn't seem to be constructive dialogue. So what's going on? And does this new openness, does it help this situation in any impactful way?
So there are two things to say about this, I think. One is that it isn't so clear that they're going for a nuclear weapon. Our own intelligence community decided in 2007 and has reinstated that belief twice since then, that they have suspended their nuclear program. On the other hand, they have done many things and endured huge costs because of programs of enriching uranium and building a reactor to make plutonium that have no other rational explanation.
Right. I mean, the evidence seems to indicate the recent evidence seems to indicate that that's where they're headed.
Well, no, I'd say the recent evidence is more that they have set it aside. On the other hand, they are not willing to give up for reasons of national pride and technological prowess, and also because they've made such a huge commitment to this, to these technologies, the commitment, for example, to enrich uranium. And, you know, we should understand that because there are lots of times that we as a country do things that on a strictly cost-benefit basis are quite irrational for reasons of national pride. And so, you know, and they have also, the supreme leader has issued a fatwa, the most serious document that he can do, a religious edict, in effect, saying that the country does not want nuclear weapons. And they have said very clearly also that nuclear weapons are not part of their security doctrine. So it is a we can't be sure, 100% sure of anything, right? We can be deeply skeptical because there is a 17-year record of them doing things that have no other explanation. But on the other hand, there is also recent evidence that they've set it aside. So, and there's no question that Rouhani, the current prime minister, is a much more moderate, Western-looking leader than Ahmadinejad, who I think really was an outlier. He was, with his Holocaust denial and his anti-Israeli rants, he was not he was an outlier. But on the other hand, there's so many on the other hands with Iran. There is a lot of politics in Tehran. And Rouhani has got to show results soon, or he will be shoved aside by the reactionary forces, the Revolutionary Guard, which will get to the supreme leader and say, this was a mistake. Get, you know, get rid of him, force him out, or put him in a box. So we have both a technological question and political dynamics that are very, very complex.
You can join our conversation with Jessica Tuckman Matthews, president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM, on Twitter at ESSPGH, hashtag EPLive. So where is Iran in terms of developing its nuclear capabilities?
Well, in the temporary agreement that was reached last November and went into force in January, Iran agreed to give up its stockpile of 20% enriched uranium. 20% enriched is not enough for a weapon, but it's far along in the process of getting to the 93% that you need. And they agreed to give that up, and they agreed to freeze production so that they didn't increase the amount of 5% enriched, which is the level you need for a reactor. They also made a whole lot of other commitments. They gave up a lot in exchange for not very much, a lifting of $7 billion worth of sanctions, which is a tiny amount relative to what they are living under. So the temporary deal, from our point of view, was much more than we expected to get. But on the other hand, as you said in your setup piece, the recent news is not so good. The early news was very good. They kept every single one of, they met every deadline. They answered every question. We have daily camera downloads from these facilities. We have inspections, daily inspections. So early on, it was a very strong performance. Now, recently, there are things that are looking not very encouraging.
And the deal that went into effect at the start of this year that was brokered last November.
Right.
And it was extended in late July.
Right.
But then after that was extended, we saw Iran, you know, miss this major deadline to provide information about its nuclear research, declare it will not allow visits to a military site suspected of being part of nuclear component testing, and said it is completing work on more powerful centrifuges to make right. nuclear fuel. So if Iran is not playing some sort of a shell game here with its nuclear components and stalling for time, then what are they doing?
What we're seeing almost certainly is domestic politics. So the site that you mentioned, the military site, Parchin, very, very sensitive, as our military sites are. We don't like foreigners walking around our military sites. We, at the beginning of this process, the negotiators got the military to agree to one visit by the IAEA. Then there was a second visit. Now they wanted a third visit, and the military said, no way. You're giving up too much. You're being weak-kneed, et cetera. That's it. So what we are seeing in all likelihood is the give and take, the pushing and pulling of domestic politics between the forces of moderation who want an agreement, which includes the current prime minister, and the forces who don't. And it's important to remember.
And if they don't want an agreement, is it safe to assume that they don't want an agreement because they want to have the nuclear capability?
Not necessarily. Part of the reason is that there are lots of people who profit economically from Iran's being cut off by international sanctions. And that includes many of the leading members of the Revolutionary Guard. So now we're in a situation that always happens with effective sanctions, is you get black markets and workarounds.
These people are profiting because they can provide what the sanctions are taking away.
Precisely.
I want to get into some more about trust issues here, but I do want to welcome in our caller on the line. We have Steve. It's 412-246-2002 if you want to join the conversation. Steve's on Route 30. Steve, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. My question is it possible that Rouhani's election was partially or substantially caused by the damage that the public felt from the sanctions, the weakness in the rial, now seem to be, our government and says that if Iran doesn't agree to reasonable agreements with the West that will reinstate sanctions, it appears that just about everybody in Europe who can is rushing to Tehran to see if they can make deals, and that the damage to the rial will not be repeated. And hence, in that sense, Rouhani may be more dangerous than Ahmadinejad. A sheep in wolf's clothing may be worse than a wolf. Hmm. A wolf in sheep's clothing may be worse than a wolf.
Yeah, we get the analogy there. So, what would your response
be? Iran has had almost no sanctions relief so far. The agreement was $7 billion, and it's a tiny amount relative to the more than $100 billion worth of sanctions in place. So, there hasn't been economic relief. There have been European and other investment groups that have indeed been rushing to Tehran, but that is to get positioned in the hope that there is a deal rather than making deals now. There was a period with Russia where it looked like they were going to try to do a barter deal around the sanctions, but so far the sanctions are still there. I haven't seen any so I don't think that the scenario that you sketched matches the facts. I also, if you look at Rouhani's life and at all of his behavior since he was elected, and at the enormous risk, political risk, that he is running in trying to get this deal, and at his prior efforts years ago when he was the Iranian nuclear negotiator, which was as close as we ever got in that period to a deal, I think you take Rouhani at face value. What you can't do is take Iranian politics at face value and where the supreme leader might go if he thinks he made a mistake in letting these negotiations move forward.
Are the Russians as determined as the other countries in this arrangement to keep Iran from building nuclear weapons?
The Russians are, to say ambivalent is an understatement. They don't want a nuclear Iran on their southern border. And they want good relations with Iran because they also have a restive Muslim population in their south. And they have a very lucrative deal with Iran, which they don't want to lose, to provide the fuel for Iran's one power reactor called Bushehr and maybe follow-on reactors. So part of what Iran is saying in this negotiation is that they want to break that part of the deal and be able to make the fuel themselves. So Russia is torn that way. Russia also sees that if a deal is reached, it will be a victory for the United States. And the very last thing that Putin wants right now is to give a victory to the United States. So they are just torn, almost split right down the middle on this.
Let's go to Ted in Mount Washington. Ted, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with Jessica Tuckman Matthews, president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Yes, sir. I love your program. Real quick, what is Iran's relationship with Saudi Arabia and also with the Iraqi government?
Iran and Saudi Arabia are the two – see themselves as and are the two major powers in the region. And if we are going to have some sort of working together to combat ISIS – there's going to have to be an Iranian-Saudi agreement of some kind. But Saudi Arabia is a conservative Sunni government, and Iran is a Shia government. So while they might both see share a common interest in defeating ISIS, they have opposing views on what would follow ISIS. Saudis would want a Sunni government, and the Iranians would want a Shia government. So it's a very tough balancing act and a very uncertain one. And the Saudis and indeed all the Gulf states don't trust Iran, are frightened of Iran, its size, its power, and its resource wealth. So it's tough.
Thank you, Ted, for that phone call. As we wrap this up, the question that we need to look at here is, can we trust Iran? I think is what we really want to know, what Americans want to know. If not, where can we even go from here? And if so, how do we engage them as this program advises us? What is the new way forward?
So what are the choices in dealing with Iran? One choice is keep doing what we've been doing for the last 15 years, more and more sanctions, more and more pressure, more and more effort to get the international community to cut them off, in effect raising the price. We've seen what this means, that the Iranians, partly for pride and perhaps partly for determination on the nuclear front, have been willing to swallow massive costs in order to keep doing what they were doing. So Iran has gone from having 300 centrifuges to having 20,000. That clearly doesn't work. All right. So that's one option. Option two is a deal, and option three is an attack. The war option is awful. We don't really have time to sketch it out, but it will end up only delaying the program for a few years. It will convince every Iranian in the entire country that they have to have nuclear weapons because otherwise – they have no security. There's nothing attractive about the war option in terms of just a hard-headed balance of costs and benefits going to war. So that leaves you with a deal. The deal can't be based on trust. It has to be based on monitoring, on close inspections, on daily camera downloads, on what Iran gives up and our ability to monitor that. And the question is, can we reach a good enough deal that is technically acceptable and politically that the Iranians are able to swallow politically? And I think we don't. I give it maybe 50-50, maybe 60-40. And the other option will be to sort of continue to kind of muddle through on the and see if we can extend the temporary agreement that we got last November, which is actually quite good for us because it stops their program from moving forward.
Jessica Tuckman Matthews is president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and one of the advisory members of the Iran Project. She is part of Engaging Iran, A New Way Forward, a program being hosted later today by the World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh at Point Park University from 5 to 6:30 p.m. Jessica Tuckman Matthews, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure, Paul.
How much of an impact is money from the oil and gas industry having on Harrisburg? That's coming up on Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.